Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, when Pope Francis takes possession of the Basilica of St. Mary Major, a musical meditation focusing on the second glorious mystery of the Rosary. The year of faith and popular piety, Pope Francis set to meet with confraternities, marking the canonization of Pope St. Celestine V, 7 centuries on. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Saturday afternoon, Pope Francis had something to look forward to, a visit to one of Rome's major basilicas. It was the first Saturday of this month of May, and he was set to lead the rosary in the major basilica of St. Mary Major, a place he'd already visited on the very first morning of his pontificate. Let's recall for a moment how upon his election as Bishop of Rome, he'd anticipated he was going to go and pray to the Madonna so that she might protect Rome. And so it was that the newly elected Pope went to venerate Mary in this most ancient of Christian basilicas in the West, dedicated to her, going directly to the Pauline Chapel to the left of the main nave to pray in front of the icon of the Madonna Salus Populi Romani and placing a floral homage on the altar there. On this occasion, Pope Francis also went to pray by the main altar of this major basilica built over a reliquary containing, according to tradition, relics of the manger where Jesus was laid as a baby. Subsequently, the Holy Father, as we know, a Jesuit, crossed over to the Sistine Chapel, right across from the Pauline Chapel, to pray in a place especially significant to Jesuits. It's where St. Ignatius of Loyola, founder of the Society of Jesus, celebrated his first Mass on Christmas Day 1538. It seems that St. Ignatius had wanted to celebrate his first Mass in Bethlehem, but not being able to do so, chose St. Mary Major with its relic of the manger as an alternative. At any rate, what I'd like to do now is fill you in on a legend connected to the Pauline Chapel, which houses the icon of the Madonna known as the Salus Populi Romani. An icon which this first Saturday of the month will be placed unusually to the left of the main altar when Pope Francis presides over the recitation of the rosary at the main altar of this major basilica. It's a legend which tells of a miraculous snowfall during a sweltering Roman summer, an episode the Roman faithful still mark today with prayerful celebrations and a cascade of flower petals from above, symbolizing snow that fell on the 5th of August of the year 358. I once visited this chapel with the late Monsignor Charles Burton Mouton, who was at the time one of the canons of this basilica. Stay tuned and find out more. Above the main altar, there's a beautiful icon of what I imagine to be Our Lady of the Snows. It's to her that the Basilica of St. Mary Major owes its existence, doesn't it? It was a scorchingly hot day in August, and it snowed?
Yes, on the 5th of August of the year 358, there was a heat wave in Rome and a miraculous snowfall, and Pope Liberius came and traced where to build the basilica, and there was a patrician gentleman called Giovanni who owned the property, and the Church of St. Mary Major was built on the occasion of that miraculous snowfall.
When you say that the plan of the basilica was traced on the ground, this was countryside in those days, wasn't it? This is St. Mary Major is right in the heart of Rome today. In those days, it was countryside, wasn't it?
Well, the Esquiline Hill is very historic, and poets and writers like Ovid and Horace were here, and there were magnificent Roman villas. And it was part of the city of Rome, but of course very different from the city of Rome that we know today because the gardens have all disappeared and the construction is all around it, done very much by Pope Sixtus V.
The icon of Our Lady goes back to when?
There is a tradition that St. Luke painted this icon, and it was discovered by St. Helena when she was looking for the true cross of Jerusalem. It's at least from the 5th century, and there's a great deal of devotion through the centuries to this image, this painting representing the Blessed Virgin Mary and her child, saving the city from plague, from famine, from destruction. and being carried through the streets of Rome in procession. And there's a great deal of popular devotion to this chapel, this painting, this icon, the Blessed Virgin Mary, by the people of Rome.
Monsignor, you talked about popular devotion to Our Lady of the Snows. I believe there's a ceremony that takes place in August every year here at the Basilica that evokes this moment when Our Lady appeared, and it snowed in Rome in August?
It's a very popular ceremony where flower petals come down from the ceiling or thrown down the ceiling in commemoration of the miraculous snowfall. And this is done at the Pontifical Mass in the morning during the Gloria and at the Pontifical Vespers in the afternoon and during the Magnificat. So on that one day of the year, we have the ceremony of the rose petals coming down from the ceiling in commemoration of the miraculous snowfall. It's a very popular religious devotion in Rome, and many people come for that ceremony. And it takes you back to the foundation of the church and the people, the Roman people. This icon is called the Salus Populi Romani, the salvation of the Roman people. And they people frequently manifest their devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of God, in this basilica and in this chapel and before this painting.
Well, as mentioned earlier on in the broadcast, given Pope Francis is set to lead the glorious mysteries of the Rosary on Saturday in this basilica, as he takes possession of the last of the four of the major Roman basilicas, I'd like to share with you a musical meditation focusing on the second glorious mystery of the Rosary. Why don't you join Monsignor Philip Whitmore?
As you can imagine, there's no shortage of fine choral music to celebrate the Feast of the Lord's Ascension. But I'd like to move on now to consider a remarkable piece of 20th century organ music, written as an extended meditation on this same mystery. L'Ascension by Olivier Messiaen was originally written for orchestra in 1933, but transcribed for organ the following year. The third movement, which we're going to hear now, was added in the organ version. It's called Transport de Joie, Joyful Cries of a Soul Beholding the Glory of Christ, which is also its own. Messiaen was a church organist himself at La Trinité in Paris for over 60 years. The French have a fine tradition of liturgical organ music and especially improvisation. It must have been wonderful to hear Messiaen improvising there Sunday after Sunday. The final movement of L'Ascension is called Prière du Christ montant vers son Père, Prayer of Christ ascending towards the Father. Messiaen bases it on a text from St. John's Gospel. Father, I have made your name known to them. Now I am not in the world any longer, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Slowly and calmly the music rises, caught up in rapturous contemplation of this timeless mystery.
And you were listening there to our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. But why don't we look to another special day during this year of faith, the Day of Confraternities and Popular Piety, one which will conclude with Holy Mass celebrated by Pope Francis in St. Peter's Square, an event Archbishop Bruno Fisichella, president of the Pontifical Council for the New Evangelization, said at a recent press conference in the Vatican will be attended by well over 50,000 people. It will be a moment of faith, he said on this occasion, that finds in the simplicity of the expressions of popular piety its most deep-rooted core in our people, who live these signs uninterruptedly as a reminder of the faith of previous generations and as a tradition that should be witnessed to with courage and enthusiasm. These confraternities offer a lively witness to a variety of age-old local traditions of religiosity, often symbolized in priceless works of art. On Sunday, for example, in St. Peter's Square, there'll be an icon of Our Lady and Child, Our Lady of Abundance, with reference to the protection of the local agriculture and crops. It dates back to the 13th century, known locally as the Madonna di Quintiliolo. Quintiliolo relating to the land once owned by a Roman general by the name of Quintilius Varus, on whose property it was found. History relates that a peasant by the name of Isidore was ploughing the land with his oxen one day, when the animal suddenly refused to budge. Peering closer, Isidore saw that an icon of Our Lady had been unearthed by earlier ploughing. Today, both Isidore, since canonized, and the oxen are still in the picture. Isidore is the patron saint of the local confraternity, and the oxen, well, they're represented by the men who herd them in the hills above the town of Tivoli, around 30 kilometres, inland east of Rome. These men, known as Butteri, form the confraternity, and the high point of their devotion to the icon representing Our Lady has its age-old expression in a procession which takes place in the month of May. When this icon, set in a gilt Baroque frame with Our Lady dressed for the occasion, as popular piety often dictates, in an embroidered mantle, is carried a roughly 3 kilometre distance from the country shrine of Quintiliolo, where it is normally housed, to the nearby town of Tivoli across a deep gorge. Carried in prayerful procession led by the local prelates, followed by the local Butteri, the sturdy of whom carry the icon itself on a heavy cedar wood platform. A popular procession, to the sound of prayer and song, which winds along clinging to a hillside road, making a couple of stops along the way, and at the start of which oxen participate. The first stop is by a Marian roadside shrine at the top of a steep hill, the second by a little ilex-shaded terrace overlooking cascading waterfalls on the other side of the valley, where a little private chapel dedicated to St. Anthony, attached to a former convent, stands proud, and the third, at the outskirts of Tivoli, by an impressive marble triumphal arch topped by carved winged angels dating back to the early 20th century. At this point, welcomed into town by the local bishop and town authorities, as well as by a volley of fireworks, it is placed on an elaborate throne and makes its way across town to its temporary resting place in the medieval neighbourhood, the Cathedral of St. Lawrence, built over what remains of an 11th century church. There, this icon of the Madonna and Child, considered to be miraculous, rests until the month of August, when it makes the return journey back to the country shrine of Quintiliolo, in which it is normally housed and taken care of by Capuchin friars. Finally, to end the broadcast, why not mark an anniversary taking place this Sunday, 5th of May? On this date, well, 7 centuries ago, back in 1313, Pietro da Morrone, Celestine V, was declared to be a saint in Avignon in France, a canonization that took place a mere 19 years after his death. His story is especially interesting to us not just because of his saintly life, but because he was the last pope to resign willingly before Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus. For the record, it was 1294. Certainly, the case of Celestine V offers relevant parallels in this respect. And with hindsight, rather significantly, Benedict XVI showed an interest in this former successor of Peter on more than one occasion, beginning with his declaring a year dedicated to him from August 2009 to August 2010. The first in the town of L'Aquila in 2009, when he removed the pallium he was wearing, which he'd received when elected, and placed it on the casket containing the remains of Celestine V. But while week-long celebrations are underway this week in Abruzzo to mark 7 centuries since this 13th-century saint's canonization, I thought I'd like to focus on the figure of Celestine V with an historian. His name is Father George Fazoco, but not without listening before to an archive report from 2010 relating to Benedict XVI's pastoral visit to the Abruzzo region. Stay tuned. On Sunday, 4th of July, Benedict XVI travelled by helicopter east of Rome to Sulmona, a town perched on the slopes of Monte Morrone, a mountain which gives the name to one of his predecessors to the See of Peter, Pietro da Morrone. Simply because this man, who as Pope took the name of Celestine V, once lived there as a hermit and became popularly known as Peter of Morrone. From above, the Pope was able to admire, as he mentioned himself a few moments later, the beauty of this area. And above all, some of the places linked to the life of this future saint and Pope. In particular, the hermitage of St. Onofrio, where in 1294 Pietro da Morrone learnt of his election as supreme pontiff. During the conclave which took place in the Umbrian city of Perugia. Yet the Pope insisted, while 8 centuries have gone by since then, he still has a place in history. Not just because of the historical time in which he lived and exercised his pontificate, but above all for his holiness. A holiness which, rather than belong to the past, continues to shine through the ages, expressing that age-old tension of man towards God,
esprimendo la perenne tensione dell'uomo verso Dio.
We often don't have time to listen nor enter into dialogue with each other. Let's not be afraid, he said, to listen, to immerse ourselves in silence, so we can hear not only the voice of God, but also that of our neighbour. Secondly, the Pope said, we should, like Pietro, be attentive and discover God through grace. God always anticipates us, and we can recognise his grace in every good and beautiful thing. Pope Benedict pronounced these words during the homily of a holy mass celebrated in the beautiful main square of this city, with the backdrop of the landmark medieval aqueduct, which runs through the town, present at the time of Celestine V's life. Located on the fringes of an area of Italy struck by a massive earthquake in April of 2009, and where there's also a high rate of unemployment with ensuing economic and social problems, the Pope highlighted a series of issues connected to these problems, assuring those present of his prayers and encouraging them to persevere in their witness of human and Christian values, so deeply rooted in the faith and history of this territory. A territory, he also noted, in which Pietro da Morrone matured the experience of creation, the handiwork of God, and one in which today There is an environmentally friendly campaign of the territory and of the stewardship of creation. But this begs the question, who exactly was Pope Saint Celestine V, whose relics Pope Benedict venerated? Professor George Fazoko, Research Fellow of the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Bristol in England, helps us better understand.
We have to recall that the Church had been without a pope for over 2 years, and in 1294, Peter of the Morone, as he was known, was living quite happily as an 84-year-old abbot and hermit. And he had indeed lived as a solitary for essentially his entire adult life, so over 60 years. And he surely was hoping to end his days in peace, but one day in July of 1294, he witnessed a procession of cardinals and the King of Naples and other dignitaries ascending the mountain on which he was living as a hermit, and had them announce to him that he had been made pope. Instead of resisting or trying to refuse this honor and duty, he accepted it. And I think this is the most striking thing about him as Pope.
And so it was that humbly and obediently, this hermit and future Pope famously made his way riding a donkey slowly down the steep and windy tracks of the Mount Moroni, onto the city of L'Aquila, for his coronation. Making an entrance, Professor Fazoko remarks, that embodied the spiritual outlook of his time, which placed an emphasis on simplicity and poverty. But what about the coronation, then?
It's difficult to know precisely how many people were in attendance. Some reports say that there were as many as 200,000 people present at the time. What is certain is that despite the solitary location of L'Aquila, many people did make the effort to be present, and they witnessed an extraordinary and unique coronation. L'Aquila was very much, I suppose, would be called a new city, a new town. So, yeah, we have the unusual coronation of a pope in a remote place, normally associated with secular power rather than papal power.
And after that coronation, as we know, there was a short papacy. Yet, Professor Fazoko tells us, one which was action-packed, highlighting in particular 3 points.
First of all, the pardon that he initiated on the day he was crowned. Second, the number and type of cardinals that he nominated. And third, his renunciation.
So let's take a look at some of the reasons behind this abdication Professor Fazoko mentions.
It's impossible to answer with certainty because we do not have the exact words of his declaration of abdication. What we do have are contemporary reports and a kind of summary of it written not long afterwards by his papal successor, Boniface VIII. We can be quite sure that he decided to abdicate over a period of time. This was not something that he did on the spur of the moment. He didn't wake up one morning and say, "Oh, I'm quitting, I'm fed up." He gave it very serious contemplation, and he consulted more than once with cardinals and people he could trust outside the curia. It is clear that he and those around him believed his abdication to be legitimate, first of all. His motives appear to have been manifold, but what strikes us most among the motives that we read about and hear about are his humility, the weakness of his body, his inability to deal with what he perceived to be evil among certain groups of people around him, his desire for the merits of the quiet life he had once known, and the need to return to tranquility. These are all dancing around each other as factors in his abdication.
So, setting aside this abdication, how did Pope Celestine V become a saint? Why not delve deeper into this canonization, an aspect Professor Fazoko has a particular expertise in? What we know is that it was 1313, and the Pope at this point was Clement V. But let's listen on.
It was a process that was pushed forward very strongly by the King of France, Philippe le Bel, Philip the Fair. This was part of his campaign to blacken the memory of Pope Boniface VIII, who succeeded Celestine V as Pope. The actual process of canonization began with the first of the Avignon popes in 1306, when Pope Clement V ordered an investigation to begin, and he sent two bishops, the Archbishop of Naples and the Bishop of Valva, that's current-day Corfino, and Sulmona, to meet people who could speak firsthand about Peter and his sanctity. They conducted what was up till then the largest canonization process that had ever been undertaken. We know that they interviewed over 320 people. And what they were concerned about was to discover as much as they could about the deeds and the miracles attributed to Peter. Notice I'm using the name Peter because technically that is the name of the person we're talking about. The person we've been referring to as Celestine would have been Celestine only for the few months of his papacy. They looked at all the evidence of the miracles and moral worth of Peter, and the cardinals met several times to consider these. Finally, in 1313, they agreed upon a dozen or so miracles. We have, interestingly, even the minutes of the final meeting of the cardinals, and it's interesting insight into the mind of the time. As a result of all these meetings and considerations, on the 5th of May, 1313, Peter of the Morone was declared to be a saint in Avignon by Pope Clement V.
And a big thank you there to Professor George Fazoko, Research Fellow of the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Bristol. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.